The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the show. My name is Martin Luke, and today we're going to be taking a look under the bonnet of an AIM-listed media localization and technology services company that helps major film and TV studios translate, subtitle, dub, and prepare content for global audiences. I am, of course, talking about Zoo Digital. Now, their share price has struggled in recent years, but to be fair, after restructurings, its latest trading update showed a return to positive adjusted EBITDA. But with the revenue still down year on year, the key question is whether this is the start of a genuine recovery play, or is this just a cost-cutting story? Joining me to answer these questions, and hopefully much more, is their CEO, Stuart Green. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Pleasure. Now, you've guided to at least 3.8 million of adjusted EBITDA for full year 2026, which is in line with market expectations. But revenue fell to $42.3 million. How much of the EBITDA recovery reflects a structurally better business? And how much of it is simply just the result of ripping $7.3 million out of the cost base?
That's a very fair question. And I think to answer it, I perhaps just need to give you a little bit of context for what's happened over the course of the last 3 years in our industry. So as you point out, our focus as a business is on the film and entertainment industry, in particular in the area of streaming, where we provide services to large content producers and streaming companies to help them get their products onto their streaming services and distribute it globally. And as you say, a big part of that is localizing the content, because obviously to launch a new TV show in a new country means you need to adapt it for the language spoken in that country. But we also actually take care of some technical things, some under the hood things that you need to do to make sure that the content will play properly, you know, it will stream nicely, there were no glitches in it, no horrible artifacts on the screen, the picture and the voices will be synchronized and all those kinds of things. So there's quite a big technical job that needs to be done, and we provide that the service around that as well. So things were going pretty swimmingly until early 2023, as this market was growing strongly, and you know, obviously everything was moving over to streaming. But in 2023, there was a bit of a wake-up call for the industry, particularly for traditional media companies who have for so long relied upon traditional routes to market. So think, you know, traditional television broadcast, cable TV, and so on. And if actually you look at the way in which that whole ecosystem has operated, it has been very reliant on revenues that are generated through, you know, advertising and content licensing in that traditional world. And that traditional world is obviously falling away and it's moving over to streaming. So for the last 3 years, we've seen in our sector a huge disruption, you know, huge seismic change as traditional players, big studios, have been moving their businesses across so that they are better able to deal with the challenges and opportunities presented by streaming. And to give you a sense of that, you know, obviously when streaming was first introduced, it was really about pre-recorded programming, TV series, feature films, and so on. But now it's about the full range of content that traditionally we enjoy as consumers on normal network television. So what's happening is that streaming is becoming the new TV. And as part of that, activities, content, you know, operations that have existed for so long in that traditional cable TV, network TV arena have been moving over to streaming. And that has caused that transition, that shift, has caused a lot of disruption in our sector. So during this time, obviously we and all our peers in the sector have had a tough time of it, to be honest. You know, back in our FY23, we made revenues of $90 million. And the numbers that you've just mentioned obviously are a long way back from that. But it's a reflection on that disruption and how that has impacted the whole supply chain in the sector. But it is in transition, And it will, it is coming out the other side now as we see it. So to get to your question, what is it that we've done here? We've just basically taken costs out to make us a profitable business. Well, clearly we have taken a lot of costs out, as you say, 7.3 million in the period. That's no small task. But what we've been doing there is actually we've been adjusting our business to be better suited and optimized for this new evolved market as it comes through. So, for example, one of the things that we've been doing is moving more of the fulfillment of the services we provide to our operations in India, where we have two facilities, one in Mumbai, one in Chennai. And in the course of that transition, we have taken costs out of more expensive locations, such as the US and the UK in some cases. And that has enabled us to operate a much more efficient organization. During that time, other things have happened as well. So we've continued to innovate with technology. We've embraced AI. I'm sure you'll want to know more about that. But that has enabled us to operate a much more efficient business and fulfill these services in a way that is more cost effective and is quicker, which is a key requirement of our customers. So the short answer to your question is that, this is very much a kind of reframed business optimized for the opportunities in our sector that we see ahead of us.
But to get to the bones of the matter, then, though, at what revenue level does the current cost base start to produce meaningful free cash flow?
It's actually a very, it's a very scalable model. There's a lot of operational gearing within it. And because of the way in which we use technology, as we generate incremental revenue, a lot more of that translates into free cash flow. So certainly, clearly at the level that we're operating, or that we have indicated we will operate for our FY26, generating sort of 3.8 million of EBITDA and generating cash, it gives you an indication of the sort of level at which, our platform is able to start to throw off cash. And obviously we see, a great opportunity ahead of us to now be able to scale that business up from that cost base and generate cash as we go.
I think, well, investors will welcome a move back into the positive adjusted EBITDA, but with revenue below last year's 49.6 million, why should they view this as a recovery play rather than just a business that's been run more tightly?
Yeah, no, I understand and why the optics of that look a little bit odd. Our FY26 was a continuing period of industry disruption. So in which there's been quite a lot of volatility in terms of the activities that we've seen coming from customers. And during the course of FY26, we saw quite different sort of profiles in the two halves. In the first half, we had a significant amount of one-off business. So a particular customer was essentially was going through licensing large catalogs of content, and they asked us to do a lot of the work to prepare that content so that it could go out on streaming services. And that gave rise to that sort of flattered our first half. And that was actually a volume of business that we had expected to come in our FY23, which were well documented at that time. So it actually was delayed by 6 months. It came in the first half of our FY26. And I'm sorry, so FY23, our prior year. And that gave rise to a first half result that was higher than we would have expected had that business come through on the time frame that was originally indicated. In the second half of the year just completed, again, we saw continuing disruption. A particular customer held back on investing in new content and new distribution, and that basically gave rise to a lower than expected result from that particular customer in the second half. So that combination of things sort of gave the outcome of that was a full year that was actually down on the prior year, but clearly on the restructured cost base, a much more efficient business that you can see coming through at the EBITDA level.
I want to move on, if you may. You've talked about recent RFP successes and onboarding several new business groups. but I'm not really getting a sense of the scale here. Are these meaningful revenue opportunities, or are they relatively early stage customer wins?
Another good question, and it is somewhat frustrating for us, as it will be, of course, for investors, to be able to actually give put more meat on the bones of that very question. The issue for us actually is that in our sector, the way in which customers operate is that typically they will have a panel of preferred vendors who they will place work to it for particular service lines. And in our case, we are a preferred vendor for a whole range of customers around the areas that we've described, media localization and the media services, the technical things that accompany it. So as we look at the kinds of projects that are coming through, typically they are a mix of those across the range of those different services. So the difficulty is that as one of a number of suppliers, we can get a sense of how much a customer is going to be able to spend in a particular area, but what we can't be sure of is what proportion of that will receive, and also over what time frame that will actually emerge. Because typically our customers are very cautious, so as if they assign new work to a new supplier, they'll want to do that in a very measured way to make sure that there aren't going to be any hiccups, that they won't be disappointed in terms of turnaround time and quality and so on. So that takes a little bit of time for it to come through. And we're at the point now where, as you say, we've had successes in these RFPs, these requests for proposals from a number of different customers. We have been appointed, and now we're at the early stages of doing sort of first projects. Our expectation is that those will ramp up over the coming months, and that will turn into very meaningful revenue for us. But right now, we don't have that visibility, and therefore we need to remain cautious, and our guidance has reflected that. So the short answer is these can be very significant contributors to our business, but we're not at the point yet where we have real surety over the levels of revenue that would transpire.
Help me to understand then, are these long-term relationships, or are they sort of project-based assignments or framework style agreements? What are they? That's why I'm trying to get into the guts of it.
Understood. They are framework type agreements. So the RFPs in our sector generally are about selecting vendors to provide certain service lines over a long period, 3, 4, or more years, typically is what we see. What they result in, if you're selected, they result in entering into what's usually referred to as a master services agreement, which essentially sets out the legal framework and operational framework that will be put into place between the customer and the vendor. And within that framework agreement, it will set out pricing of the different service lines. So those things are generally all agreed. So then what happens once this is in place is that the customer will essentially place work with you as a vendor. So typically you're not negotiating on price on individual projects. Those projects kind of come through as a natural course of that relationship. So they are over the longer term, usually 3+ years. They typically don't come with commitments. That's just the way in which the industry works. But if you are a preferred vendor and you do a great job, which we do, then it's reasonable to expect that you'll receive, a good proportion of the work that's placed by that customer.
Okay. I want to take a quick look at the balance sheet. Now, your cash at year end was $3.2 million. You have a $1.1 million draw under invoice finance facility. You've also expanded the US facility from $3 to $5 million, and you also have a £2 million UK facility, if I'm correct.
That's all correct.
Now, if we were to look at the bear case, which I'm going to, and volumes were to recover more slowly than you'd expect, how comfortable are you with that current balance sheet?
How comfortable? I think that's a great question. So based on the way in which we are performing at the moment, and our reasonable expectations of how that will play out over the year ahead, We absolutely believe that we have enough strength in our balance sheet and access to facilities to be able to, deal with the, the peaks and troughs that inevitably come through in terms of work volumes. So I think the question, how happy am I or how comfortable with the balance sheet? Obviously, it's always great to know that you've got real strength in the balance sheet. That just gives you so much flexibility. But I think in our current circumstances, the nature of that borrowing that you mentioned there, that drawdown, is that essentially it's a timing thing, isn't it? It's invoice financing, so it's all secure. It's effectively a lender giving us cash from invoices that we've raised to a customer a little bit earlier than that customer will pay us. So it helps us smooth out the cash flow. So I think the cash position that we reached at year end was a good one, given where we've come from and all the challenges that we've gone through. And of course, as implementing significant savings in costs, as you mentioned that we've done, inevitably there's some consumption of cash in order to do that. If you're closing down facilities or reducing facilities and staffing and so on, then there is an associated cost with that. So I think for us to come through that period and still have a stronger cash position, that was a great result.
So, can I assume the company can fund the recovery from existing resources?
Absolutely.
Good. Okay. That was the question I really wanted the answer to, if I'm honest. But then
Course.
let's move on. I mean, fast track. Now that sounds strategically important. Reducing localized delivery times from weeks to hours is a strong claim. But how commercially material is it today? And I mean, in terms of actual projects, revenue, margin contribution.
Yeah, okay, great question. So again, if you could just indulge me, I'll just give a little bit of context. The kinds of services that we provide, can range typically, historically, they're activities that vendors will take, maybe days to produce, sometimes weeks, in some cases months to turn around. The most extreme case being creating dubbing output. So taking a program and producing an alternative language version of that program by having actors who are speaking the words in a different language. And I'm sure we've all encountered examples of that before. The thing about dubbing a program and to a high standard is that it's actually quite a challenging process to go through. So technically there are some real challenging things you have to deal with. So working out what scripts these people are going to speak so that they match reasonably well onto the to what the original actors are saying when they're on the screen and so on. But of course, you also to do it well, you need to have different voices. So when different characters on the screen speak, you need to hear a different voice. So if you've got a typical, I don't know, a TV series, a drama series, or something like that, there might be 50 or more different characters in that program, and when you dub it, you need to make them all sound convincingly, different people. So consequently, you'll cast a large number of voice actors to do that thing. Now, of course, getting if you're trying to get 50 actors all together in one place and record their lines, that would be a nightmare to orchestrate that just because of coordinating availability and diaries and all the rest of it. But of course, in the same way that when you make a feature film or a TV series, you don't have all the actors of the whole thing all in the same place at the same time because you film it in different scenes and different scenes will have different characters, and so you can kind of plan that out. So when you're dubbing something, typically you've got to cast all these voices and you've got to arrange for those actors to come into a traditional studio. I'm speaking about the way in which this is done traditionally in our industry. And so it's a big diarization challenge, really. You've got to find out when those actors are available, when they could come into your studio, sort out transport arrangements and maybe accommodation for them. So it's quite a logistical challenge to deal with that. And consequently, it takes quite a long elapsed time in which to do it. But if you look at over the course of that elapsed time, how much time is actually spent working, it's a relatively small proportion of the overall elapsed time. So what we've done is What we've done actually for a number of years is to create and develop these platforms, internet-based platforms that allow us to do this work in a very efficient and scalable way. That mean we don't have to own and operate physical studios in lots of places. That we can, again, through access to suitable recording spaces, we can access talent and bring the elapsed time of that down to a much shorter period. So for several years, we've been able to produce dubbed soundtracks in a much shorter period of time than our traditional competitors in the sector. But you ask about Fast Track, which is a brand new initiative from us. And what we've done there is really taken that a step further and provided a way in which we can materially accelerate the time in which it takes to do this by engaging with talent around the clock. So an example of a requirement for this would be, for example, let's say, a sporting event where you've got lots of punditry and commentary and interviews and all sorts of things, interleaving with the event itself. And if you want to, when you of course, if you want to make this event available to your consumers, they'll want to see it live or near live. And if those consumers are in lots of different countries, then you need to provide different language adaptations for them, and you need to do that very quickly. So the way in which our Fast Track service works is that we have talent available around the world who can work around the clock as the sun moves, so that people are kind of working in their normal working day, and our systems are enabling us to very efficiently and reliably move the work from one location to the next, as people wake up and come into work, and then as the day ends in the earlier kind of working zone. So overall, we are, as you say, we're able to dramatically reduce the time it takes to deliver the results without necessarily dramatically reducing the actual work involved. That said, we are also, and this is a key part of our Fast Track offering, now employing the use of AI in certain places within our processes so that we can do this work more quickly, more efficiently, more reliably. We have to be very careful about how we use it because, of course, it can make mistakes, and quality is all important to our customers. So this combination of things that we have, the technology platforms we've created, our follow the sun strategy to work around the clock, together with the integration of AI within our solutions, means that we've been able to dramatically reduce the time it takes to deliver without us having to reduce the price at which we charge for these services. And indeed, for the fastest services that we deliver, and we're actually actively delivering dubbing projects that would normally take a month or more in 24 hours. So to do that, clearly we're able to charge a premium for that kind of service. So there are certainly premium service elements in this offering.
You touched there on AI-enabled localization, and that could well be a differentiator for you. But I'm assuming it could also put pressure on pricing if major studios were to use the technology to squeeze suppliers. I mean, I suppose, and we're seeing this across many industries, of course, but is AI helping you expand margins, or is it becoming a tool that customers can use to push down your costs?
That's another great question. So I think you use a key word there when you said tool. That I think it's tempting to think about AI solutions, especially when you kind of see them on social media posts and so on, as being some kind of panacea. Some kind of way in which you just sort of hand over your information, and the AI system will give you the answer, and you take that to market, and you're done. But of course, whilst that may be true in certain applications, and there are some very well documented cases in point, in our sector, where the accuracy, the reliability, the authenticity of the material, this localization material that's being produced, is so critical that AI is not, certainly at the moment, and for a long time will not be this kind of panacea of a solution. This just throw your information at it, and it will kind of give you the result, and you can kind of go to market with that. There are sectors and segments where it is being used in that way effectively. These are mostly on things like user generated content. So for example, if you're a creator on YouTube and you've videoed yourself baking bread or something, and you've got a big following of people who are interested in that, then creating, a dubbed version of yourself or a subtitled version of yourself in different languages so that people in other countries can enjoy your baking, that's a very cost-effective way of you extending your reach. But that's not the target application that we're concerned with. We're concerned with premium brands who really, really value the quality and authenticity of these localized materials, because their consumers likewise feel that this is really important. And as a result of that, you need to do it really well. So for us, AI is a tool. It's something that we can use in certain areas in order to make our operations more efficient, more scalable, better in certain instances potentially, but it's not a panacea. So it's not something that where we see it's reasonable to expect that our customers will basically insource some tool and use that to produce the localized materials. We believe that for the foreseeable future, they will still need to work with trusted vendors who know what they're doing, who can provide a very high quality result, who may in turn be using AI to assist in the process. I think your question is still valid then. So does that put pressure on us from a pricing standpoint? Do our customers expect us then to charge them less to do that? Well, there may be instances where that is true, but I think what we're seeing in the market is that there are other things that are more important to our customers. Prices obviously is always, and costs are always important. But what's happening more and more within our sector is that the demands of our customers to reduce time to market is an intense pressure. There's an intense pressure on vendors within our sector. So, and this is where obviously our fast track solution and the technologies that we've built are really making a difference, because we can help our customers get their products to market much more quickly. And in so doing, we're able to maintain the pricing that we put in place. And because our customers are saying, well, yeah, okay, it'd be nice to shave a bit of cost off these services, but actually, if you can reduce the time that it will take us to get this product to market by half, that's much more valuable. So that's kind of where we see our opportunity in this industry.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, finally then, Stuart, I wanted to wrap up with Gillian Wilmot stepping down, and you're going to appoint a new independent chair and audit committee chair. Oh, sorry, a new independent director and audit committee chair. Is that right?
Yes, we're actually we have two board members who are retiring this year. Gillian Wilmot, who is our chairman, and also Mickey Khalifa, who's our current chair of the audit committee. That's right.
Right. Okay. So I suppose my question is, given where you are in this sort of recovery phase at the moment, what skills are you looking to bring on board at this stage? Is this about sort of a corporate governance refresh, industry expertise, or is the new financial oversight you're looking to bring in?
Well, clearly, as we given all the kind of turmoil in our industry and how that has affected us, governance is clearly front of mind amongst our investors, to ensure that we are going about this in the right way, that we're being challenged in what we do. So as we're looking for new non-execs in these two roles, clearly having experience there of particularly the AIM quota market, but certainly the sort of listed environment is important to us. As Mickey Khalifa, who's our current chair of the audit committee, as I mentioned, will be recruiting a new independent non-exec to replace him in that role, and that's quite a key role from a governance standpoint, and therefore we will be appointing someone who has great credentials and track record in that regard. For the second of the two replacement independent non-executives that we'll be looking for, we are We're seeking someone who has some really interesting complementary experience in our market or in some adjacent sectors or somewhere that can provide us with some really interesting and valuable sort of added value. And we're excited by a refresh of the board and bringing some new ideas and some new eyes on the business.
Well, Stuart, thank you so much for that. I'm sure investors will be grateful for the update. I think the question is now whether you can turn a sort of cost-led recovery into a revenue-led recovery, which we have faith in you to do so. And I, for one, am very much looking forward to the next update.
Thank you very much. It's been great to chat with you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.